Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Human Rights, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rin Veith, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Kim Kelly about her new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Thanks for being with us today, Kim.
Thanks so much for taking the time and being interested in my little book.
I wonder if you'd begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself.
Well, I'm a lot of different things, but I think in this context, I suppose the most important one is that I'm an independent labor reporter. I've been freelance for the past, 3 years, and I'd started writing about labor a few years prior to that. And before all that, I worked in the music business. And what kind of changed my trajectory there was that the place where I was working, Vice, we unionized, and I got super involved and was super excited about the whole thing, and ended up kind of metamorphosizing from a heavy metal journalist into a labor reporter. And so that's what kind of led me to this point. And I guess just on a more personal note, I do come from a union family, like a blue collar, working class, rural family of construction workers and steel workers and teachers out in South Jersey. So I grew up knowing about unions and appreciating unions, but never thought I would get the chance to join one myself until that happened in 2015. And so I'm just really excited to be here and have this book coming out so I can share my excitement about labor with everybody else.
Fantastic. I know that you said a little bit about this in your bio just now, talking about your experience in a union and your family history, but I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what led you to write this book.
Sure. Well, I can't imagine writing any other kind of book. It's the opportunity. Like, I've been working with a book agent for a few years now, and I was originally going to write a book about heavy metal. And that kind of changed as my own focus changed. And when the opportunity came up to put together a proposal and get out there, I thought, okay, what do I want to do? Oh, I should just build upon the work I've been doing already as a journalist, and especially with my Teen Vogue column that I've been doing since 2018, which I've kind of been using. I think people that read this book that are familiar with those columns will see a lot of common ground. Like, I've been using that platform to dive into these forgotten labor histories and these forgotten labor leaders and center more marginalized voices. And when the opportunity to write a whole book came up, I was like, oh, cool. Now I have a little bit more time, a little bit more space to really dig into these people and these campaigns and these strikes that I knew a little bit about, but you can only fit so much into like a 1200 word web piece. Like, I finally got to nerd out, and it just happened to be during a time of great upheaval and a consciousness shift among the workers in this country around their lives and their labor and the values of both. So, yeah, I guess it was pretty good timing, as much as one can plan these things.
Yeah, I guess sort of shifting away from some of the excitement and the optimism in the book, which I have questions for you about as well. Throughout the book, you actually note a number of ways in which some labor unions and groups didn't necessarily fight fight oppression or fight for equality in the ways that we might like. For example, you mentioned the Chinese Exclusion Act a number of times. Why did you feel like this was something that was important to include?
I think if you love something, you should feel able to criticize it and help it get better. And I don't think ignoring the ugly parts of the movement's history does anybody any good. I think it's actually really important to look back at the mistakes and bad decisions and just horrible, bigoted BS that some labor leaders decided they were going to get into, because that shows, you know, how far we still need to go and how far we've come. I think it's, you know, learning our history is very much a warts and all process. Like, it's not all pretty. It's not all nice. Sometimes it gets pretty ugly. And I think if we want to really be, fully cognizant of the, the burdens we carry and the mission that we're carrying forward, like, we got to know where we came from, even if it's embarrassing or upsetting or, you know, awful. Like, because there's been some awful stuff scattered throughout labor history, because, you know, maybe the right people weren't always in charge, and the right people maybe didn't necessarily get to grab the microphone or lead the strike. Like, sometimes, you know, sometimes the bad guys are in charge, and we have to confront that if we're going to make things better.
That's fantastic. your book goes back in time, decades, sometimes hundreds of years, and then comes up into the nearly present moment. I'm guessing as well, with some ongoing strikes, that you are perhaps updating things right up until deadline. How do you see the past reflected in current labor organizing efforts and also just public discussions around labor organizing? And I'm thinking in light of COVID-19, which you mentioned throughout the book, but also this significant media coverage around unionizing that at least I haven't seen in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's wild to see. Like, it's really cool, especially as a labor reporter, right? Like, oh, wow, people are paying attention to these things I've been screaming about, and a lot of other people have been screaming out for years. And some folks have been screaming about these things for decades. And I hope that they are also enjoying this new spotlight on worker stories and on the work that they've been doing way before I was a twinkle in my union organizer's eye. But yeah, one thing that's so, I mean, to go back to being excited, I'm like kind of a Pollyanna about these things. I'm just really stoked all the time about labor. But one of the things that's so exciting about seeing all this coverage, this attention on current worker struggles, is that it's inspiring people to get involved and start organizing themselves. And in order to do that effectively, I think it's important to look back at the past and at lessons that other organizers and other workers came up with and other tactics they used, what worked and what didn't work. I mean, even just thinking about the success of the Amazon labor unions in Staten Island, the way they organized and the way they approached that work, it really brought to mind the work that Dorothy Lee Bolden was doing back in the 60s in Atlanta. She was a Black woman who was a domestic worker and who began working in that field when she was a child and grew up doing that work. And she decided she was going to put together a labor organization for the other Black women that she worked with, because there weren't any unions at the time that were really, you know, knocking down those doors trying to organize domestic workers. But she realized, okay, well, we need to come together. We need to organize. We need to demand better, because the status quo is not acceptable. And she took a very similar approach to what Chris Smalls and Derek Palmer and those folks took. Like, she talked to people she knew, she related to them on a personal level as a worker, as a woman, as someone that they knew from riding the buses and from seeing her at work. And she built up this network of, I think at its height, it was about 10,000 members throughout Atlanta in the South. And they were able to, you know, push for higher wages and to professionalize the work and got really involved in voter registration. Like, they moved mountains, and they didn't do it within the traditional labor union framework. They built their own, and it worked. And I think looking back at examples like that can be so useful for folks who are trying to organize now, who maybe don't see a place for themselves within the traditional labor movement, or like whose jobs don't fit neatly into a category that falls under an existing union. Like, you can do it yourself. Other people have been doing it for centuries. It's just, you know, helpful to look back and see how they pulled it off and figure out how you can build on that.
Yeah, I'm also, so in reading this, I noticed a number of stories that I was familiar with, just through my own work, through my own reading. I also have family in the greater Boston area. So stories about Lawrence and the Mills, and anyway, just a lot of really, really fantastic descriptions. And anyway, just it was really wonderful to revisit that. But at the end of your book has chapters on three groups with, of course, a lot of overlapping membership. I was particularly excited to see included in a book about labor organizing, which is, which are, I should say, sex workers, disabled people, and prisoners. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the inclusion of sex workers, disabled people, and prisoners in this book on labor, because I think it is absolutely important. And I really loved, in particular, the way that you also talked about how, for example, a number of, you know, workers would, you know, not infrequently become disabled because of their organizing as well. That these are, I don't know, that's just that they're very important categories to think about.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I love every chapter, of course, but those three really meant an especially great deal to me, because those are the kind of stories that you really never see brought within this kind of general labor history. Like, they don't end up in the labor history box very often, right? Like, there's a lot of great books about those specific groups and what they have done and their specific struggles, but the intersections between them is where all the power is built and where the most interesting stories come out. And something that came out to me, like, really clearly when I was researching was, you know, I went into it knowing that there must be intersections and just kind of assuming like that there'd be a little bit of overlap, but seeing how much overlap there were between different movements, it really kind of blew my mind. And it kind of made me a little bit angry that I hadn't heard about them before. Like, even just like the long history of sex workers engaging in activism and organizing and standing up for their rights when nobody else would, like, that goes back decades and decades, like, way back. Like, there's such a precedent there. And the fact that we're talking about this and there's a group of dancers at the Star Garden in North Hollywood who are on strike right now, some people in the labor movement have been showing up and showing solidarity, but not nearly as many as we might see if it was a strike being led by, I don't know, janitors or retail workers or another group of worker. There's still that stigma. There's still that extra layer of marginalization. And I figure that if I have this chance to write a book, to write a labor history book, I can finally bring in everybody who has always been here, who has always been part of the struggle, but for various reasons, whether it's just stigma or whorephobia or classism or racism, transphobia, like whatever oppressive reason that you have decided not to bring these folks into your narrative, like, I could dispel that. I could put them in my labor book because that's where they belong. Like, I learned so much about the history of incarcerated workers organizing. Like, I knew a decent amount about it just through, you know, being involved in various abolitionist causes and like having one of my best friends was in Rikers last year. But just going back to the 70s and before, like, there's so much history there. And like you said, when it comes to talking about disabled workers, like, I mean, that one was a little extra personal because I'm disabled and it's just kind of nice to learn more about my people, if you will. But yeah, because I mean, it's a, like, I'm in this book too, right? Like, I wanted everyone to find themselves in this book. But when I was doing that kind of research and seeing like these very specific overlaps, not even just in terms of general liberation or general accessibility, like thinking about, for example, the Section 504 protests and occupation when disabled activists took over federal buildings in a number of U.S. cities. I think the biggest was in San Francisco, about 100 people. And they occupied these federal buildings for days and sometimes weeks. And in San Francisco specifically, they were able to pull this off through community support and through the support of labor and other like justice minded organizations. Like the Black Panthers kept them fed. And when some of the leaders went out to DC to speak to Congress, the Machinist Union like gave them resources and provided transportation by renting like a big box truck, because a lot of these folks used wheelchairs and used mobility aids. And this was before public transportation had to be accessible, so these activists couldn't get around. So a union stepped in to help. And just reading about things like that made me feel so, it just kind of gave me this warm little glow, because I love seeing the ways that people come together and the way that struggles intersect. And I really hope that putting these specific groups in my book will maybe open some other people's eyes to the plight of their fellow workers and help them get past whatever biases and prejudices they may have, and realize that, you know, if you want to fight for workers, you need to fight for all workers. You know, it's an injury to all, an injury to one is an injury to all, not an injury to like specific people is an injury to all. Like, it doesn't work like that. You're in or you're out.
Yeah. I was in the sections, and in those three chapters in particular, I was really compelled by the way that you wrote about, the structures that lead to certain kinds of inequitable working conditions, not just systemic oppression, but additionally legislation that mandates different kinds of minimum wage for disabled workers, for example. And I was thinking about how the thread of working conditions really, I mean, obviously, like that is obviously, you know, much of talking about unions and labor organizing. But in particular, I was really struck when you were writing about those working in garment factories in the past, and also right until, you know, the moment of COVID, and how those working conditions were still. I don't know, really, really horrific. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more again about that reflection between past and present.
It just shows that so little really has changed in like in a material sense for so many of the most vulnerable workers in this country. And it's just, it makes you mad, right? Like we went through, well, not we, but people like us went through these horrific tragedies and these brutal struggles and these endless strikes, and tried so hard to make things better. And even when they won, in so many cases, that was a small victory or a fleeting victory. I mean, we can talk about the Triangle Factory fire and the important legislative reforms that came after that. And that did help. Like, that was very important. Like, no shade on Frances Perkins or anybody who was doing that kind of work then. But then you think about what's happening in, for like, Los Angeles, for example, which is just a massive population of garment workers who are predominantly Asian women and Latino women from various other countries. And even like the woman I interviewed for the book was, you know, told me about what she deals with on a daily basis, and what she's breathing in and what is scattered around the workshop and how the doors are closed. And it's just, you wonder, like, have we learned nothing? Like, is it going to take another massive fireball and another 146 dead workers to get someone who is in power to pay attention and try to make things better? I mean, if you think about, you know, the coal miners on strike in Alabama right now, who I've been covering their struggle for the past year. And obviously, like, the technology has changed in some ways, the machinery has changed, but they're still spending just as much time underground as their dads and their granddads did. And they're still breathing in the same recycled air. And there's still coal dust and silica in that air. You know, black lung is back on the rise. People like to think of black lung and these horrible occupational diseases as a thing of the past, but they're not. And there's so much more that could be done to prevent people from suffering in this way, but the people in power just don't care, and they never have. That's why building collective power among workers, among the working class, is really our only chance for survival. Like, we got us here. We're the only ones who can get us into a better place.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So throughout the book, there are, really, really horrific things, like the fire you described, a lot of really, difficult things, I would say, to read about people organizing and the response from the government or from employers. But the book still seems to have quite a lot of optimism, which you sort of remarked on when you joined the call. But the optimism doesn't seem to be naive at all. It's this very like measured optimism of, even if it's not happening now, then it there's this possibility in the future. And so I was wondering, if you would consider this an optimistic book, or if this idea of a future possibility factored in while you were working on it.
I think it's a very true book. And I think it's true that eventually the workers are going to win. It's taken us a really long time, but you kind of have to keep that sort of hope, and you have to dream as big as possible, because giving up and succumbing to negativity and succumbing to pessimism, that's how that's how the bad guys win. That's how the bosses win. It's when people give up is when the people in charge are able to grind their boots into our necks a little bit harder, and I think that the history of the working class in this country is so inspiring. It's not in a hokey way, just in a very visceral way. Like, look what we have done. Look what we've pulled off. Like, even people that have been like aggressively oppressed and marginalized and shoved to the side and shoved into the shadows, like, have accomplished incredible things and made huge impacts on their lives and the lives of subsequent generations. Like, we should be proud of ourselves. And yes, there's a lot of work left to do, but I think people know that. I don't think anyone goes to work as a union organizer without knowing that there's this massive task ahead, but they still go. And the workers who are organizing themselves are still doing it. Like, I don't know. Like I said, I'm a little bit of a Pollyanna, and I guess that probably comes through a little bit. I don't like being a bummer. I don't like focusing on the negatives, because there's so many negatives. Like, if you focus so much, like, exclusively on all the times we lost, you're not going to want to get out of bed. But if you focus on the times we won and try to learn from that, then that just helps us win a little easier next time.
That's really interesting. Thank you for that. Something else that I was reflecting on while reading this was how frequently issues of sexual violence or sexual harassment came up as reasons to organize, or as things that would help people. Things that became major issues, particularly in terms of working conditions. And I think in part I was particularly struck by just the openness with which that was confronted, and how that was actually seen as a labor issue. And I realize it sounds a bit, strange perhaps to say, I read these passages on these horrible things that happened and came out with a sense of optimism because people were, engaging with this. But I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that, just particularly I noticed that this particularly came up in terms of Black women organizing and also janitors and domestic workers.
Yeah, like, I mean, sexual violence and sexual harassment, like, that is absolutely a labor issue. That is a workplace issue. That is an employee management issue. Like, it's funny, when I was researching this book and kind of pulling all these little threads together, really just realizing how much kind of everything is a labor issue when you think about it, because most people, almost everyone really, is either has a job or is going to have a job or did have a job. That's kind of this almost universal experience. And of course, there are people who are more vulnerable to specific kinds of workplace safety issues. And, you know, I think about Suzette Wright, who is just an incredible ray of sunshine and such an incredible character. I'm so lucky I got to know her during this process. I actually met her a couple years ago at a panel at Georgetown about addressing sexual violence within the labor context. That's where I met some of the workers with Yabasta too. And I kind of kept that in the back of my head. And I talked to Suzette, who, she was a worker at just an auto plant in Chicago. And she started working there and she was pretty young. And she actually followed her father into the factory, and he didn't want her to. He wanted her to go to college, but she had to support a child, and she wanted the steady work. So she went in there, and she just had to deal with the most heinous and constant sexual harassment from her coworkers and managers. She'd put up with it as long as she could, but it had a very drastic impact on her mental health, and she eventually had to leave. But she blew the whistle against Ford, and she put into motion this whole kind of, she just put into mention a movement that eventually resulted in settlements being paid out and apologies being made, and these women who have suffered so much getting not what they deserve, because they deserve the world, but getting a little bit of payback for what they underwent. And being able to write about that just felt really good, because I'm like, I feel like most women and a lot of and non-binary people in this country, like, I've also had to deal with things like that at work. And it was really satisfying to see someone win. And the same goes for the janitors who are involved in the Yabasta, I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, but Yabasta campaign in California, which was a group of janitors, predominantly Latina women, basically came to their union and was like, look, we're dealing with this horrible, demoralizing, dangerous issue. You need to do something about it. And they launched this whole campaign, and they trained hundreds of workers as promotoras, like kind of community liaisons, to talk to people in the community and talk to workers and teach them about their rights and about how to stay safe. And it kind of snowballed into a whole thing. And that happened because these workers realized, like, okay, this is a workplace issue. This is something we can bring to the union, and we need to make them listen, because this is a safety issue. It's a mental health issue. It's everything. Like, when you're just trying to go to work and someone is debasing you and threatening you in that way, like, you're not going to be able to get your job done. That's a labor issue. So all that to say, I'm glad I had the opportunity to kind of bring those threads in, because I think it's really important, and it's not necessarily something that gets top billing when we talk about labor issues at work. But for the people that experience it, it can take over your entire world.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really appreciate how you managed to bring in so many different issues that I think many might not consider quote unquote traditional labor issues, but just really made it clear that, yes, you know, these are labor issues, and here are how many people have addressed them.
Yeah, it was, I guess that's just, and I'm not like special. I've just spent a long time thinking about these things in various contexts and trying to play catch up to other people on this beat. Because like I said, I was in the music business for a long time. Like, I spent most of my life thinking about heavy metal, but even when I was in that context, especially after I like educated myself politically and kind of saw more of the world and got out of the woods, I started seeing how these interlocking systems of oppression impact people in the heavy metal community, and how people with different identities and backgrounds suffered and felt like they didn't fit in to this, you know, this community that is tailor-made for misfits and weirdos. Like, if the weirdos won't let you into their weird club, where are you supposed to go? And I guess I just had a little bit of background in thinking about these things. And then by the time I made it to labor, it just made so much sense to me. Like, oh, well, this is clearly all connected. Like, I'm not an economist. I'm not an academic. I'm not good with numbers. But I know people. And I know people who have had to struggle. And I haven't had the easiest ride myself. So I suppose that's just the approach I went with, because it's the only approach I know.
Well, Kim, we've taken a lot of your time today. Where should listeners go if they want to read more of their work, or if they want to pick up a copy of Fight Like Hell?
So the book's on pre-order right now, but it should hopefully be in stores wherever books are sold. And I always hope that people choose to support independent bookstores in their neighborhoods, or hit up Bookshop or IndieBound, because I don't think Amazon needs any more of anyone's money. But and otherwise, I still write a lot. I'm still a freelancer, and I post everything on my Twitter, and I have a Patreon. Still can't say it. But yeah, I'm very online. I'm pretty easy to find, and there's not that many reporters that look like me. So just if you see somebody covered in tattoos with really long hair and a bunch of metal in her face, you probably found me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, for talking with us today.
Yeah, this is a really great conversation. I really appreciate that you pulled out some of these kind of deeper threads in a way that was really satisfying and fun. Like, I really want, like, those three chapters that you highlighted really mean a lot to me. And I think maybe not everybody wants to talk about that stuff, because it's a little tougher, a little more difficult, but that's why we need to talk about it. And that's why I put it in there. So I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for talking with us, and have a good rest of your week, and congratulations on your book coming out.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.